If you don't have a problem, you're not enabling growth. It's an effective attempt to build a learning and adaptive organization that's capable of self-sustaining growth and aligning to changing customer value. The development of capability of the people became primary, and secondary became these techniques. Secondary became this desire to see some machine working appropriately.
Welcome to KPI Fireside. Our mission is simple: to improve companies and to improve careers through continuous improvement. In every episode, we explore the spark, the moment, the mindset, or the method that ignites real change. Whether you're just starting out or leveling up, you'll find the insights and inspiration to fuel your next improvement. Welcome back to KPI Fireside. I am your host, Keith Norris. Today, our guest is Tyson Heaton. Tyson is a senior director of co-learning and business strategy and senior coach at Lean Enterprise Institute. We are in studio together. Tyson lives in Utah, where I live. Tyson also spent 12 years at OC Tanner. So we are discussing all things lean, and Tyson is an expert in lean and all things culture. So welcome, Tyson. Thanks, happy to have you here.
Appreciate it. It's good to be here.
Wonderful. Wonderful. So we always like to start the conversation with our guests about a little thing we call the spark. And so most of the folks that are involved in this continuous improvement lean thing have some moment where they were like bit by the bug or the spark. I'm wondering if you have a moment that you recall from your history where that happened to you.
I think for me, I've been bitten repeatedly by various ticks that would leave me with the lean fever, as you would say. Early, even before I understood what lean was, in school, I was studying political science, and I've always been really curious about learning and adaptive systems and what makes something sustainable and able to grow and adapt and adjust to the environments that it was in. That was part of what brought me to political science and understanding why do some of these things stay up and in complex systems and topple. But my first trigger exposure was I was sitting in a first year lean management program thing, and they were teaching some of the TQM material of project management. I remember thinking, well, yeah, why wouldn't you just think this way? This seems like the appropriate way to solve and go after a problem, you know, fishbone diagram. What's the purpose? What are you trying to achieve? And that was like the first real bite. And then successively, you know, there was like a TWI job instruction training bite, and there was a Toyota production system bite. So there's just all along the way, I continue to get bitten. I guess it'll learn my lesson.
Interesting. So you were at OC Tanner for a long time, and OC Tanner bought down on the lean journey, I guess you could say. Are there some things along the way, milestones that you recall, maybe your own journey of how that evolved and opportunities that you had inside OC Tanner?
Yeah, I think what drew me to OC Tanner was the job instruction training. I'd done a lot of operations management jobs before, and I'd try and step away from the job and the things would fall apart. And I was in love with my solution and I'd see it crumble and I was like, I don't get it. And so I'd stumbled across TWI, this job relations, job instruction, job methods, foundational skills for leaders. And I thought, if I can get this going, that'll be great. And so when I went to OC Tanner, they won the Shingle Prize back in the 90s, like 96, 97. They're a culture building company, recognition company. And they really seem to have nailed the intersection of like culture and lean. And the most profound thing I learned at OC Tanner, I think going into OC Tanner, a lot of times I was frustrated with people when I was trying to make change or transformation. And it wasn't immediate. But after about like 5 or 6 years, something flipped where the development of capability of the people became primary, and secondary became these techniques. Secondary became this desire to see some machine working appropriately, like the engineer's desire to be like, I've tuned the machine and it's humming. Somewhere along the line, it flipped. And that was transformational for me. I'd owe that to OC Tanner. Other things, OC Tanner was just an incredible playground, high trust with their people. So you get to play with all types of lean techniques and tools that fundamentally rest on a lot of trust and are really hard to prop up outside of environments that haven't enabled some level of trust and capability.
It makes me think of the respect
foundation of lean. And with people, you touched on something that I find very interesting is I think that as humans, we tend to judge ourselves by our intentions, but everyone else by their actions, mm-hmm. right? So you said like, hey, this thing that I built, why can't they understand it, right? They're stupid. They don't understand what I do.
If I can just get them to understand, everything would be great. Yeah.
And I think we all have this, we all tend to forget what it's like not to know,
yeah.
right? And once you know something else, it's like hard to remember what it was like. So as you talked about the instructions part, there's just so many lessons here. For somebody, most of the folks that are listening to this have some exposure, familiarity to continuous improvement. Your current organization, the Lean Enterprise Institute, tell us a little bit about the mission of that organization and what you guys are all about.
Yeah, so the foundation was established by James Womack. He wrote The Machine That Changed the World. The group he was working with coined the term lean. Sometimes he's happy about that. Other times he's like, I wish we would have chosen a better word. But I think no matter what you would have called it, the depth and complexity and capability that comes from it is bound to some level of misinterpretation. But our mission as an institute is to advance lean thinking and practice. And primarily we do that. But we have a lot of materials that you can look at and see online. We've done a lot of book publishing, and we have a robust kind of learn by doing methodology. A lot of lean sometimes turns into this like theory, and a lot of if I can get the theory across, then the practice will work. We really believe that moving quickly to learn by doing, and that the best way to change thinking is to embark upon changing behavior and engaging in the work of lean transformation.
Are there, for anybody that is just getting familiar with what lean is, it's one of these things that you hear, there's so many experts on these topics, right? And it's something that the idea of lean perhaps is evolving as well, as we get to, I suppose. Are there some core pillars or building blocks that you might say, these are some areas to understand about lean?
That's a really good question. I think the longer I spend doing this type of work, I feel like this could be my definition rather than the shared definition. I think that's one of the beauties of values and things that are complex, is it's like, take the things that resonate with you. As far as, I mean, there are core principles. There's like flow, customer value. What is the value to the customer? Elements of where you separate a worker from automated work or problematic work. So the worker has the ability to like think and handle complexity. So if you think of these situations where everybody's in work and they're, things interrupt your day and you lose focus or you can't stay in a flow state, it kills innovation. So like Jakota, is it the foundation of enabling kind of a lean organization? And then stability. Stability is another huge piece. But I would say these are like foundational things. Maybe, you know, you can draw the Toyota house. But I like to take a step back to when the word lean was developed. There's a story where they were talking. It's like, it's fragile systems. Like, I don't think we can sell fragile system. And so they dumped into, you know, lean was the word that emerged. But I think there's a ton of wisdom behind this concept of fragile system. If we can just talk about that for a second.
What is a fragile system?
And so in the context of lean and fragile system, if we look at, let's say you look at a value stream, you look at subsequent processes. And in order to facilitate the movement of these processes, typically there has to be some inventory, some product that moves from step to step. You have to have some people working the product. You have to have some methods. So this process transformation or value stream. There's something in all of us that says, I want this to run smooth, so I'm going to add some inventory so that problem is buffered. Or I'm going to add some labor so that that problem is buffered. And so when we add that excess to cover those problems, we're like, it's running smoother. That's great. Lean is the process of systematically stripping away the extra so that the system reveals to you the places where you should most fix it. So this idea that we want to make sure nothing breaks, right? No. Let's peel the system back to a place where we get lots of micro fractures. And the micro fractures tell us where the work is most needed to fix. And that is where our problem solving will be most effective. That is where we can focus attention for capability building. And if we design our value stream in a way and we systematically work to bleed the edge of stability, then the small problems get revealed and we're able to work on them incrementally for continuous improvement. And it fundamentally creates a system where the organization is caught in that learning stage of adaptability. So it continues on this path of growth and adjustment at each level. And fundamentally for me, that is the unique thing that Lean brings to the space in terms of learning and adaptive organization. It pursues flow, pursuit of customer value. It knows that stability is key, and it spends less time arguing about which problem to solve because the system reveals to you which problems you should be solving by stripping away the excess. And it's not about making people work faster. It's not about stressing your machines to breaking. It's about finding the stabilizing point and resting it on that edge. And it's in those states, you know this, where if you find yourself in the rhythm of balance of work, thoughts come to you, innovation shows up, right? It's not about creating a chaotic environment. It's about bleeding that edge of challenge. And so I like the fragile systems view. I think it was is too much to get your head around, and Lean was easier to sell, but I like that definition myself.
I like that. Fragile systems is a very interesting concept. We had a prior guest, thinking Alan Barnard, talked about the anti-fragile system concept.
Anti-fragility is a fun.
You touched on a few things which I love, and this is one of the reasons why I love doing this podcast, is talking to folks that are interested in this kind of thing. I think that, you know, problem solving is something that is very human. You know, we like to solve problems. You talked about flow, which builds on the research of, was it Mihai Csikszentmihalyi?
Yeah, Csikszentmihalyi.
Flow. Yeah. And it's just, when you're in that flow state, you just feel better. Like you have a better day. Like there's some stuff about this lean that's very technical and tactical, but some of it is just like, it's good for the human spirit, mm-hmm. you know, to work in a place where you feel like you've made a difference, that you've done some good, that you've had some good ideas. So I think there's so many things about the lean tool set and skills that I think just promote having a good day at work generally. Yeah. And flow is a very good example of that. So come back to this idea of the pillars of lean. Like if you were to put this into like a box, you know, draw some boxes. What are some of those other boxes that you might recommend people understand?
So I think most of the time when we talk about these pillars of lean, or even the Toyota, which emanates from the Toyota house, the TPS house, we're generally speaking with reference to an operating system or a production operating system. When we talk in terms of lean enterprise, what we notice is that there are some, maybe I would call them pillars, or I'd call them practices that we notice. If they're working well, they lead to a longer-term sustainable enterprise. And maybe I could touch briefly on some of those.
Yeah, please do.
So one piece that hasn't received a ton of attention is this idea of lean product and process development. So there's your operating system for flow, and then there's how do you innovate new products? How do you bring new products into the market? How do you leverage what you have? So if we look at engineering teams or product teams, often they're like deciding the solution and then they're trying to make it work. There are other ways to go after innovation that enable you to deliver stronger products to the market more consistently. And you can see that Toyota's done this, right? Like, how do they get into the Lexus market? How do they get in? They've just kind of been able to penetrate consistently with products in a systematic way. And lean product and process design is one of the things that we consider critical for lean enterprises. That while you can enable a system for flow and stability, if those lessons aren't being passed over into the way you develop and launch products, you're depending on sparks of brilliance occasionally from like a lone warrior to rescue you. And that's not a sustainable enterprise, right? So how do we make space for those sparks of brilliance yet find a way? So I think that's a piece that I'd encourage people to look at a little closer. We're also finding that if you can't network a few critical tools together or critical methodologies together, so like Hoshin, strategy deployment, policy deployment, whatever you want to call it, the process of catchball and socializing key objectives and critical priorities across your organization to create a focus to enable your organization to achieve its strategic end, right? And then A3 thinking, or the process of developing management thinking to more effectively execute on these objectives and to improve the horizontal flow of value across the organization. So A3 thinking, the ability to collaborate over a problem, the ability to build your management team's problem to solve problems, we see as absolutely critical. And then effective daily management system. So it's like, how do you understand stability? How do you keep problem solving at the appropriate level in the appropriate place in your organization? And how have you focused those teams on delivering the value that they have? Everyone in the organization can't see the whole value stream. It's crazy. Sometimes we think, well, everyone needs to understand the whole flow of value, right? Your Hoshin and your A3 and your management team, you need to have some type of chief engineer or process person to look across the flow of value and be a custodian of that flow of value. But you also need an effective daily management system that is built within teams, at teams, to keep them focused and solving problems at the right place. And so we really are seeing those as critical to maintaining and advancing an enterprise related to these lean principles.
Let me come back to a couple of concepts that you shared and just ask you to define them for us in a sentence or two. So A3 thinking, what does A3 thinking mean?
Yeah, so A3 is like, in its simplest form, it's a piece of paper. A lot of our thinking we do on our own. So how do you show someone your thinking? And then if you can show someone your thinking, how would someone else coach thinking appropriately? Right. So we, A3 thinking is, how do we get that on a paper? Could be a digital paper, could be a physical paper, so that me and my coach or my leader can walk through my thinking and improve the way I think and go after objectives, right? By getting an outside perspective, by going through those critical steps versus like the traditional sense. It was like, well, what do you want me to do, boss? So A3 thinking is this ability to not only cascade these challenges between your layers of management, but be able to grow the thinking of the person you're interacting with in a way that externalizes problem solving away from ego and allows the organization to continue to level up the way it thinks and how it operates. Sorry, that was more than two sentences, but it's just that like there's depth to these things. That's
absolutely
hard for me. And I'm passionate about it. You can see.
An A3 is it's a size of paper.
It's a size of paper.
I've heard the phrase plan on a page,
yeah.
You know, for different things and different reasons. So A3 is a version of a plan. I like what you said, how to show your thinking. That's a really interesting way of explaining what that is. It's like, I remember, you know, doing math homework as a kid, you give the answer and you're like, show your work. I think that's a great example. What are some things that you would expect to see on an A3 form to represent that A3 thinking at different levels?
Yeah. So if I'm, well, it depends on the A3 for sure. Like, what's the intention of it? So what's the problem to solve? That should be clearly on the A3. One of the things that often happen when somebody embarks on solving a problem is they've actually got seven problems or they've got a vague problem. So to start solving a problem, you really need to get down to the prioritized problem at the point of occurrence. So it's like, I've got too many returns, or I've got a problem here. Well, actually, how many can you go observe and break the problem into chunks of what the actual problem is? I've got returns. Well, five of them are redirects, three of them are mislabels. Okay. So now we have seven different problems based off of real observations and real data. And then you have to, this isn't root cause, but you have to trace those back to the point of occurrence. So you're going to follow this problem back to a point of occurrence, and then you can begin working on root cause. So that's one of the first things when you look at an A3. All right, what is the actual problem we are trying to solve? Is it one problem or is it five? And how does that problem show up? What's the gap? Where to go after it? Before you even drop into the root cause and thinking of it and trying to explain the seven things that you want to do about it. So this is where I'd start. And then depending on the A3, right? If we're talking problem solving on a shop floor that are abnormality, kind of close the gap processes, the complete out plan where you see like, here are the options we considered. We kind of evaluated it. This is the one we're carrying out. You don't have to have a huge emphasis on sustainment because it might be like, just put the new jig in place or just add that to the PM schedule versus a more complex A3 with a target condition might include a lengthy sustainment plan that includes some, and Lean, they call it Yokotin, but it's unfolding the solution across other departments or across other areas that experience the same challenges or leverage similar processes.
Super interesting stuff there. I want to come back to a couple of topics that you shared there. First of all, Lean is one of these topics where certainly some people have dedicated their lives to it. It's everything. They work at Lean Enterprise Institute. It's everything, right?
Yeah.
But Lean, as you said, the word might not necessarily be the best word from a branding perspective. There's been some mistakes made with Lean and the way Lean was applied. Maybe you could talk at a high level. Like, there's people that probably have a misunderstanding of what Lean is. People think that Lean is X, but really it's not. It's Y. Could you talk a little bit about the mistakes or the misperceptions that people have about Lean?
Yeah, I mean, one of the benefits of Lean is it emanates out of this study of Toyota. And Toyota has a deep kind of human respect aspect towards it. And I didn't work for Toyota for 10 years. So the thing I've found with the Toyota folks is sometimes they argue with each other, which I love. But there is this tie to human capability and building human capability. And in fact, if you go to Toyota and you go to one of their tours or you go to their employee onboarding, one of the first videos they show you is of the loom. Have you heard this story?
Yeah. Well, yeah, tell it. Please do.
So the founder, his mother, would work at these looms. They'd be passing this loom through threads.
Like sewing, tapestry.
Sewing, looms. Yep, yeah. Tapestry looms. And a thread would break. And they would have to like stop and fix it and redo all the work. And so he was motivated by seeing his mother dealing with these problems, right? And so this was where kind of like the concept of Jakota was born, where it was like, I ought to be able to separate that error catching from the work my mother is doing so she doesn't have to be stressed about what's about to happen. And so they built a mechanism to automatically detect when the thread broke. So this was motivated. I always live like foundational stories, right? This was motivated by the desire to alleviate some suffering and some pain in the conditions that his mother was working in. And I think this has got to be core to Lean. And that's the nice thing about Toyota existing, is that it can persist in these principles because, right, Lean has taken on Six Sigma as a brand of Lean, I would argue. And it moved into technical aspects. Is it wrong? No. There are plenty of totally capable tools within there. But it's not primarily a cultural model, and it's okay. It's a set of clinical tools generally, and they have some mechanism for socializing it. But if we look at what Lean's become or how it's been misused or how it's been mislabeled, I'm not as concerned about it as others. I'm like, everything, right? If you're a member of a certain religion and you've studied it, you're like, man, everybody's painting us with this broad brush. Or if you're a member of a certain political party, or if you even have a hobby, right? If you're like, I love road biking, you're going to hear other people talk about road biking. And you're like, you're missing the spirit of the activity. You're wrong, right? I don't get as hung up about where it's been misapplied wrong or right. And I try and advance like what I feel is good about it and where I think it can help people and advance organization.
Let's say that there's somebody out there whose company is coming to Lean Enterprise Institute or something, and they say, hey, we want to do this Lean thing. And somebody inside the company is like, uh-oh, my uncle worked at a company and they did Lean. And then 6 months later, he was out of a job. And yeah. So that might mean I'm going to be out of a job next. How might you address what Lean is versus what it is?
Yeah, so, I mean, that's super tough because... Right. When we choose to work with a client, we have criteria related to, if you spend time on our site and you look at our tools, you'll notice that, and the way we teach, you'll notice it's very much focused on human capability and capacity development and on organizational capability. And we can go work a project with a client, right? And we can even get agreement. We can say, look, we're going to come help you with this work and we're going to help with this problem, but there will be no layoffs. There will be no job loss because of what we do. We work to ensure that organization is committed to respect, right? We can come in and work that project and get agreement. And while we work, we're utilizing some extra people for training. We're trying to build a model where the relief operators turn into team leaders, where we're building this fragile system that now we can buffer with people and increase growing and learning. And then we can walk away and they can swap their executive leaders. And they're like, wait a minute, why don't we just remove these team leaders? Why don't we just cut these costs, and all that is gone. I wish we could control that. No, I don't. They've got to learn. But I would say to that person, that's a genuine risk. Let's address it with your management team. Let's talk through with your leadership group those risks. Because if the person in the company is feeling those risks, it could be an indicator of behaviors that haven't always been appropriate and effective. And so, like, if we can have those conversations as we engage in the project, better. But I don't know how to keep people from using lean as what I call like dark side lean control, right? Like, there's two sides to the force. There's dark side and there's lean side. Are they going to use these numbers to beat people up and judge? Or are they going to use these numbers to show indications of where they should dig in, ask some more questions, and better equip their employees to be successful every day?
I love it. I can't help but jump in and say, Randy Kesterson has some great cartoons on this concept of like the dark side of lean, like Darth Vader versus, you know, like the light side with the, so it's super interesting. You know, I don't know if you've ever been in a situation. I've been in a situation where I've had to lay people off inside of my company. And I'll tell you what, as far as like the top 10 worst days that I've had as a boss in a company, like those days rank up there. Particularly, I mean, if somebody, you know, needs to be let go for performance reasons, that's different. But when you find yourself in a situation where like something didn't work and you feel responsible for it's not working, that is not something that I look forward to. And I know a lot of people get bad, maybe a bad reputation for cutting jobs and doing those things. I don't know how you feel, but maybe if it gets to that point, it's like, it's proof that there were plenty of mistakes made before that time. Like, that's kind of like the end of a bunch of mistakes made, where if you're doing some of these things that are part of this lean methodology, particularly with the human capability, the capacity side of things, like what people are capable of doing, I don't know anybody leading and running a company anywhere that wouldn't like to grow their organization and have more people doing more value add stuff. So when the opposite of that happens, it's probably more of a proof of failure than an attribute of lean.
Maybe a few things on that topic. One, if you can make an effective transformation to a lean enterprise, that means you've enabled your enterprise to be solving problems at all levels of the organization. And if you run into a situation in the market, and sometimes it's no fault of the owner, no fault of the executive team, no fault of the management team, like, markets can be violent and you have to lay off a bunch of people. If you've equipped those people while they were in your custody with the ability to solve and iterate and move through problems, they'll be able to find jobs. They'll be able to do work because their skill wasn't solely based in the technical capability that they had while they were there. They have this adaptive capability, and you can have some assurance. Maybe you can sleep better at night knowing that you've made people more employable while they were in your custody. And I think that has to be primary. This other piece that you mentioned, I think is true in that, and let me see if I understood what you were saying. Layoffs are often the result of poor management over an extended period of time. And if poor management, and it's easy to blame people, but when I say poor management, I mean like poor systems, poor measurement, a lack of an appropriate focus on your systems. The job of every person in an organization is tough. And if you don't have empathy for that job, it means you've never done it or you've never been able to slide yourself into those shoes. So I really, like, I don't want to be the person that's like those executives. I mean, they have a tough job, right? But over time, the lack of an ability to adopt effective management systems and practices, lean enterprise transformation, you'll have to lay off. Because you know, like, I think Charlie Munger was like, he talked about one of those things where it's like, these people who come in and lay off a third of their workforces, they're doing God's work, because somebody for too long let things go on for way too long, and then they're not delivering appropriate value to their clients. They're not delivering appropriate value to their customers, and they didn't even deliver an appropriate environment for their workers. They falsely created this place where they paternalistically, in the wrong way, not in the right way, where you're like, I've made my children stronger and they can go out and do this. You sheltered them and you made them less capable to weather the storm that was coming.
I think that's an interesting point. And that's something that anybody listening to this that I want to say and emphasize. If you're in an organization that's exposing you to this type of stuff, this is good stuff. This is stuff that can advance your career in your current company or make you more marketable into the future? So Toyota is an interesting company. It's evolved, as you mentioned, from looms to automobiles, and there's a lot of stuff happening right now in just human transportation in general.
Yeah.
Why is Toyota such an interesting company to model and learn from?
Yeah, so if we look at Toyota's product, right, the automobile, and they're kind of the undisputed champion, we'll say, of effective operations of building and selling internal combustion engine automobile. And the automobile is arguably like the most complex, durable good that is sold in mass market. It's the single largest purchase that people generally make outside of their home. So if you're American, it's probably a home, but that's not mass manufactured or delivered in the market. And it's got such complexity. And so they've been on this path of building the machine that builds the machine with human capability at its center. So there isn't, when I try and look for things, like if I'm like, what's the best thing that flies? Right? You're going to look at the birds, right? So when I look at like, what's the best example of managing complicated assembly and complexity over a long period of time successfully? It's Toyota. And there isn't another good, right? The TV is much simpler. Like any industrial manufactured good has not had a longer run of study and work. And so that's why I think it provides such an example. Is its evolution has made it an example. Now, you shouldn't take all the lessons and try and apply them, because if you apply some of the lessons, a lot of it's overkill. You're like, overprocessing is one of the ways. Don't overprocess your process with lean. Like, take the thing that works and makes sense, keep human capability at the center, deliver value to your clients.
So you're saying if my Lexus has a transmission problem at 77,000 miles, I shouldn't throw everything out the door that lean brings.
Right, for sure.
One other thing that you touched on that I think is really interesting about lean in general, and I'm thinking of a conversation I had with somebody who was basically a new manager. They were new in this supervisor manager role. And I think this particular person kind of had in their mindset that, you know, and they had been promoted because they were good at doing the work. And now they're in this like manager role. And it was like, I want to be seen as being competent and capable. There are no problems, right? Mm-hmm. So when you'd come and ask like, what's going on, you kind of got at this daily management and exposing the issues. I think that that's kind of an interesting concept of, you know, as you move into management, like, yeah, I don't want to have any problems. And you talked about lean as a way of exposing problems. I'm curious if you could explain that a little bit.
Yeah, I think there's a story of, I don't know if it was Tai Shiono or somebody else, but like comes to the manager and the manager's like, we have no problems. Andon has not been pulled. He's like, no problem is worst problem of all.
I think as, you know, as I asked the question, like, what is lean and what are some of the core principles, or there's even these mantras, and you shared that quote. That's one that I'm sure runs through my head and your head and others, like, you know, no problem is the biggest problem of all. I'm curious if part of the daily management system that you were referring to a minute ago isn't to expose. Problems is an interesting word because, you know, you can have huge problems, you can have minor problems. What is the role that lean plays in exposing those problems?
Yeah, so some of it relates back to that fragile systems theory, right? So if you have another story is, if I have a line and it's got seven people, there's no problems, I'll be like, I'm going to pull one of the people out, have them work on improvement projects. Now there's some variation in line output. It was like, hey, manager, why don't you go work on solving that and better balancing of labor across the line? So if you don't have a problem, you're not enabling growth. And so working to enable that flow of value across the organization is critical. And what we know, so this is maybe a core to lean, is when we time and understand value add versus non-value add work in the strictest of definition, like there's no organization that's doing like more than 20% value add. If I go, like, just think about it. You go to Toyota, right? The tires still come in a dock. Granted, they get put on a conveyor and they move in. But if you're talking like what adds value to a product, unless it's changing the fit, form, or function, it's not adding value. So management never adds value, ever. right?
That's a hard pill to swallow.
But the customer's not paying for it.
Yeah, exactly.
The customer doesn't care, right? So how do I minimize that activity? Well, I should build tools in place so that the team can manage themselves. How do I make visual the flow of value to the team? How do I put those KPIs in front of them so they can manage themselves? How do I enable stability and free up people's capacity to make those improvements? Because it's inherent, right? You like the shirt you put on this morning. How much waste was there involved? Not in making of the shirt, but just like how many days did it sit in the closet versus on your body? How many times are you going to clean? Like there's so much waste involved in terms of what we get in terms of utility or joy out of the things we receive, that there's always an opportunity to pull out the waste and not put, it's not about putting more pressure on your people. It's not asking about your people to do more. It's about we have given them processes, which is the nature of building something new. We've given them processes that are full of waste and sometimes full of disrespectful things like waiting. I don't know if, do you like waiting?
Yeah, nobody likes
it. Nobody likes waiting. But we put these things in, and then intentionally going to work to remove those is the right thing to do. And that's where management's focus should be, right? That's where if you can enable people to work in a good process, all their behaviors get better. All of them. Like you give someone a horrible process, it breaks all the time, it stops working. They're taking 30 steps when they could take 2. I'll show you a group of people who are unhappy about their work. You give someone the ability to deliberately work in a consistent routine and sequence and have their job gets better, and they become enabled to make improvements, to participate in improvement versus like, right? We all have these days, we go home and everything's been crap, and our ability to even engage in a healthy conversation with our children or our spouse is garbage. You know, it's like, let alone innovation, give me a break, right? And we know that innovation does not come from misery.
I think that's such a, and again, that's probably something that for me sits foundationally at this idea of lean is, you know, flow. When you're having a good day, when you're adding value, you know, you've accomplished something, man, it just does something more for the human spirit. So this is such good, the skills and the tools that you can learn in this lean discipline are so interesting in so many ways. I would imagine there's probably things that you've learned at work that you applied at home or maybe modified the way you deal with things personally.
A little. Yeah. So I try not to. I think Kaizen is good for work. It's not always good for home. You need, sometimes home is like the space to be lazy, the space to create waste, the space. Like, I think it's ill-advised to Kaizen your wife or your children. I think that's a horrible approach to take. I think, right? And really, I mean, you could have this philosophical question like, when you go home, you really, the value is the time you spend with each other. But it's like, right? I caution people from like turning the thing they're having in terms of joy at work by removing waste. Removing waste is fun. Like adding value is great. And improving a system so it has less waste is fun. Home is not always the place to do that. Like maybe you like making cookies in batch. Have at it, you know? And usually if you're making cookies at home, your intention isn't to flow value of the cookie to your customer, the dog at the end of the table. It's really, the flow is engaging meaningfully in this traditional activity that you've done historically. So I'm just saying, be careful.
That's probably an interesting thought experiment on what value is in those different scenarios. It also reminds me of the, I guess what I would associate with the time matrix. You know, you've got activities that are, you might consider it, well, like sharpen the saw, like rest and rejuvenation, right? At a certain level, watching TV and vegging out is like, rest and recovery. Now, if it goes too much, it's probably something else, but there's a certain level of that. I think that's interesting.
This episode is brought to you by KPI Fire, the all-in-one platform for continuous improvement. With KPI Fire, you can align strategy, drive execution, and engage your people. So whether you're leading a team or driving enterprise-wide change, KPI Fire helps you deliver real results. Learn more at www.kpifire.com.
So You were telling me about a conference that Lean Enterprise Institute was involved in. Let's talk about that for a minute. Tell us a little bit about the conference and what some of the things that you guys discussed there.
Yeah, so this conference, it was actually in Utah this year. It's called The Future of People at Work, and it's kind of an outgrowing of a conference that's been loosely bouncing around since COVID. It started with a set of .orgs, kind of institutes getting together and talking about lean and the future of lean and its impact and how it grows and what happens. And so I think last year it was in Detroit. Some of the themes were like community. How do we, like, you go talk to somebody who's deep into design thinking and you're like, wow, there's a lot of similarities between the way we might think and look at things in design thinking. And then even though business process engineering gets a bad rap, sometimes you're like, oh, wow, like this is similar to some value stream focus, right? So some of that was about communities being brought together, but really even in the lean community, some of these groups, you'll see it on LinkedIn. Like you'll see somebody post something on lean and then like everyone's piling on. They're like, how could you be so stupid? That X matrix doesn't work. And it's really, I think it's a huge turnoff, right? There's so many good things in it. So they tried to bring these institutes together to collaborate and talk and say, what is the future of people at work? We've been running these concurrent experiments, right? There's healthcare. Catalysis was there, their healthcare lean group. The Ohio State was there. University of Kentucky sent some professors there. MIT sent a few professors. The Shingo Institute was involved. Right, GBMP was involved. I'm sure I'm leaving somebody out. So you should go to the website, Future People of Work, and look at the institutes were involved. And they have different initiatives they're going after. So it's kind of like a community. And there are a bunch of industry leaders in there too. So it was hosted at OC Tanner. Out of it emerged these topics of how do we create maybe some type of unified definition? How do we bring more exposure to these principles of lean and organizations that have advanced? Menlo is always there. Pair Programming, Joy Inc., like really has done some interesting work with lean in the tech space. And just talking about these principles and some really cool topics emerged and have continued to bubble up out of it.
One of the topics that emerged was, I think you said it was augmenting lean transformation with AI. Explain that a little bit.
Yeah, so tech was a huge thing. Obviously, that's completely shaping everyone's work. If it's not shaping your work, that would be strange to me at this point. And that was a huge topic at the conference. Jamie Benigni is the leader of TSSC, Toyota Supplier Support Center. He talked about a professor he's working with who's like trying to help enable small and mid-sized businesses to use a lot of this technology because you can equip, I'm sure you do some of this, like remote monitoring and enabling work. And this was a funny story, but he went in with his professor and he went to look at it and he's like, wait a minute. First, you should cut out half of these processes because the process is bad, right? So you can monitor a bad process or you could remove and fix a bad process. So that was kind of a funny story. And there's some work emerging out of that where tech is skating ahead in some places. We could be better about integrating that into lean practice. One of the topics that's emerged for LEI, or Lean Enterprise Institute, is we have a set of research and a set of work and thought leaders who really I would consider some of the best at problem solving. Art Smalley's one of them. And they've been playing with kind of AI-enabled coaching. So can you bring a third coach into the conversation? If I'm coaching you on A3 thinking, can you run through the problem with an AI coach, and then I get insight into your thinking. I kind of need to have insight into the AI's thinking too, and that iterative feedback. And then can we accelerate problem solving and advancing people capability, right? Currently, AI is, there's some studies, right, that say it's making people dumber, or they're not thinking as much because they're getting the answer directly from AI. They're not having to search as much, right? I think that's going to be the median. I think they're like people I've observed. Some of them are using it to quickly refine and adapt their thinking and use it as it's kind of like a Socratic method. But we're working on developing and deploying basically these tools that can enable. I don't always have John Shook to coach me on a problem. I don't always have the leader I had 10 years ago who really advanced my thinking. So can we invite a third coach in that can advance the skills of both the coach in coaching and the learner in improving their problem solving capability?
So that's one of the
areas that we're focused on.
Yeah, I know that there's some interesting AI projects out there that are capturing these different voices of expertise in lean and other areas. Have you seen some of those actually getting implemented, or is it still kind of conceptual stuff?
So we have some coaches that are actively working with some clients on integrating within their system. So a lot of the clients we work with are larger companies. And so when you talk a larger company, they're going to have a knowledge management system, whether they're an automotive maker or a nuclear regulatory labs commission. They're going to have a set of knowledge, either A3s or institutional knowledge. And what they're going to want to do is they're going to want to take an AI like A3 thinking coach and attach it to that knowledge database, right? So that not only is the person getting coaching on their problem solving as they retrieve it, but it's taking advantage of that knowledge management. What we kind of believe will happen is if I try and create a tool, an AI coach, an A3 coach, a root cause coach, it may have some ability to impact and help people in their problem solving capability. Organizations that we work with, a lot of them we suspect will shut that down and be like, it needs to happen within our version of Copilot. It needs to happen within our four walls. I am not about to have Grok AI sharing the problem that this manager is working on with the world. So there's just so much uncertainty there and hesitancy. The applications that some of the applications we're working on are these direct partnerships with organizations that we've had longstanding relationships with to try and build that capability internally through either their instance of Copilot or through own tech teams so that they can link the knowledge management and database and archives to this coaching capability to intentionally continue to grow their people in a way that leverages institutional knowledge and their people's capability.
One thing that I find interesting on this topic, because I am seeing a lot of people who, there's a lot of companies that have initiatives like, hey, we need to implement AI more into stuff. Like there's a lot of CEOs and senior leaders who don't necessarily know that enough, don't know that much about AI, but they know that they need to develop those capabilities. And it comes down as like, hey, do AI stuff. And the interesting thing is that there's actually a lot of interesting ideas, and let's just call them like little skunk work projects of we could use AI for this, we could use it for that. But one thing that I think still applies more now than ever is this idea of structured problem solving in a stage gate sort of way, is you need to get the ideation of innovation and, you know, some of the concepts of lean and people closer to the problem coming up with the ideas, but you also want to have some controls in place that are HI, human intelligence, rather than AI, at least in these early stages. I think it's a really interesting kind of paradox between how the growth of AI is really limited by problem solving, and you might even say like the strategy execution of the humans that need to build the system to be responsible for it.
There are some important things happening there. One of the things that I would, if I had these executives, I'd be like, you want to know how to best use AI within your organization, get your people to tell you how they're using. Because there are people in every organization that are leveraging it rapidly in effective ways, enabling them to get more work done in less time and even produce higher quality output. You'll also find people producing loads of mediocre garbage with it.
So much.
But there are people in your organization that have learned how to prop up an instance, to build a project, to put a RAG database behind it, and to build refined outputs related to the work that they do. Most of those people are going to not be forthcoming with that for a number of reasons, right? They might not trust you. They might have done it because against your information technology policies. But those are the places where the innovation is happening right now today in your organization that would be most useful to understand and spread across your organization. I think that's fascinating.
This sounds to me like there's a best practice or a something that LEI might recommend that organizations should do. It sounds like asking, like, you know, portfolio AI, how are you using AI? Yeah. It seems so simple, right? We should ask our people how they're already using it.
You kind of would have to give a chunk of them immunity.
I think that's true. Be careful what you ask for. You just might get it.
But it's happening, and it's happening rapidly. And in every organization, right? Because it speeds a whole set of knowledge work, and everyone using it, the best thing you could do is learn from the people who are using it effectively. And when I like, or just talk to your kids, right? The way they're using it as a thought partner, as a debate partner, they become the copy editor instead of the primary writer. They can generate the thought, and they can become a copy editor. So the editing skill and the copy editor and the copy manager as a function becomes higher. In the problem solving side, the AI is going to congratulate you every time and think that you're smart until you poke back on it and say, give me some alternatives. And it's not going to force you to define the problem respective to your organization. What is the problem to solve? What is the challenge? How does it impact the value that the client's receiving? How, like, it's not going to do that, right? What it's going to do is generate for you 7 options that fill in the gap of current pain that you have. And it creates a bunch of distractions when not used appropriately. So it's this fascinating time we're in that I think is just going to lead to all sorts of interesting outcomes.
I have a bit of a philosophy on this, where AI is going, that I'll simplify as, the future belongs to the people who can clarify what they want, because we're making it so easy to get anything. The hardest part is just getting clarity on what it is that you want.
Yeah, I think that's as an interesting, deep, yeah. That's a deep statement, both for like profound happiness or joy or life perspective, right? Yeah. Like, we're awash in more than we ever have had before, and yeah, we're statistically increasingly unhappy as a mass in the center. Anyway, that's a whole thing.
Okay. One other thing that I think is a lot of things. Another interesting concept, agile versus lean. Give me your thoughts on that.
I mean, agile is having a moment right now. We have a number of partners. A good friend, Fabrice Bernhard, he wrote a book called The Lean Tech Manifesto. He's like a huge agile guy. Has his own tech company, ran into problems with scale, looked at extreme programming, looked at scaled agile framework, and then ran into this guy, Michael Ballet in France, and did these Japan study tours, and recognized that while agile does a number of things really well, it tends to break down under scale. It doesn't have anything within it that addresses scale and scaling and handling complexity. And so if you're in the tech world and you're an agile practitioner, you're kind of in this space where you're like, oh, what's happening? Business process reengineering hit this peak and then it dropped, but there are still some incredible practitioners that are doing it in a good way. And there's a similar disrupt happening within agile. Lean can enable agile to be effective. And what we're seeing with a few of our partners is when they can partner with these tech companies, tech as a product, and they can come in and teach them about flow and tact and pull and do their swim lane deployment by team and enable visibility of that flow across team and the work packets, that they can begin to transform outside of this like scrum of multiple teams, sometimes working in different directions, unclear timelines, unclear outcomes. But that when you attempt to move to scale, and this is maybe a key point, we've heard this customer obsessed or client-centric. Lean attempts to ask, what is the value? So if someone's buying a car from me, is their value in like, I want a bright pink car with all the sparkles and the client should deliver the sparkles? Like, well, what's the value for the client? They want effective transportation, right? And someone who just wants effective transportation versus wants to feel sexy when they hit the gas pedal, those are different value streams. Those are different products. And so I think Agile has done a good job of inviting the customer into the iteration.
But definition of value.
The definition of value, because it brings that client in. And when you're spinning up an individualized software packet for that specific client that's custom around it, Agile deployment is pretty effective. Now, when you're trying to deploy that solution across 100 different customers, that have slightly different interests, and you don't have a way to represent their needs outside of a product manager who's, you know, like, it just, it doesn't always stand up to scale. And so Lean's definitions of flow, value for the customer, quality built in, adoptable, reusable frameworks. So you're not, you don't have to create the same code over and over. Use the same code in all your products that do the same function and spread it across your teams. Study the work of your teams, right? The closest thing that Agile has to a team leader who's there studying the actual work done is pair programming. And that drastically increases how good your code is. But there is no role that's like, I'm studying the actual work done, trying to understand what components of the work I can take and make portable across multiple teams to build shared practice. So there's just so many opportunities to apply Lean to tech as a product and the craft of making product that I really think is kind of opening up this opportunity, and we're starting to see that there.
There's certainly some overlap. There's some, let's call them behavior patterns that exist in Lean and exist in Agile. One that comes to mind, you talked about daily management or the daily management system. In Agile, I'm thinking of like the daily Scrum or the daily
retrospective. Yeah.
For somebody that's maybe more familiar with one side or the other, how is a daily management system similar, different than, you know, like a daily Scrum, daily stand-up or Scrum?
Yes. Yeah, so, I mean, the rituals that attend Agile to help you like prioritize and select work and choose and allocate story points, that might be similar to like a production planning huddle in your daily management. And what's the work we have to do today? And what do we have to get done? This concept of tact, which even if I, right, a lot of the organizations that I stumble into that are practicing Lean, it's really hard to see tact or the rate of customer demand. That is generally a foreign concept for a lot of folks. In tech,
could you explain tact to maybe somebody in Agile?
Yeah. So, it's what's your rate of customer demand? So if you're a dev team and you're producing code or product or features, how many customers do you have? Where are they lined up? And what's their rate of demand? Right. And you'll say, well, it's never consistent. Yeah, but it follows a pattern. The pattern might be hard to distinguish, but it follows a pattern. It has peaks and lulls, and there's a pattern of demand. And so how can you numerically calculate that demand? So what are the units? What's the demand? And that would give you a rate of production. That would give you a drumbeat of production. And so if you have that rate of production, that's what you're organizing your resources towards, and that enables stability. So generally what we do with tech teams is we overburden them, and then we plan based off the story points they have available. And then there's an infinite backlog that doesn't care about the rate of customer demand, or can even often not ask questions about what's the value that the client's looking to extract. And that's the big difference between one developer and another often, is that they can see beyond the request of the client to the value that they're looking to extract, and their ability to develop a solution is faster. There are things within Agile that just, they don't ask fundamental questions that Lean does relative to scale. And I think if you're startup stage, the thing in Lean that's closest to Agile is probably like the iteration portion of Kata, or if you have a problem on the shop floor and you create a small process improvement team, and you throw an engineer and a maintenance guy and something else in there, and you just trying to rapidly deploy a solution against a problem to stabilize it, that those interactions of that process improvement team where you took a maintenance guy and a team leader and a team member and a manager, and you gave them the problem and statement, said, let's spin up four or five things really quick and try and blitz this and see if we can get a solution in place to stabilize it. Those interactions of behaviors are going to be closest from my understanding as to what an agile kind of deployment team is around those story points and those problems. So it's good. Like in that case, the production, that Scrum team or that process improvement team, which is what Lean usually calls it, they build a solution for that spot. You still need a chief engineer to be looking at the interconnection of your whole flow of value across the whole value stream, or you need a chief process integrator or someone that looks at the whole value stream. There are very few enterprises that have bought into this thing, that have bought into the idea of someone should have like custody or awareness and care for the end-to-end flow. We keep trying to be like, well, the managers can do that. No, you deployed the managers functionally to focus this way. And so it's not one or the other, it's and. And I think that's where, Agile is going to have a tough time reaching scale. And there are reasons for that. The major tech products that have disrupted and created so much value in the market are single solution products, like a Strava app, right? It's not an integrated functional system. It does one thing really, really well. And that's what tech has enabled, is the extreme optimization of a singular component.
So I'm thinking of a conversation I had recently with someone who is, I think their title is digital transformation inside of a large manufacturing organization. And he said something to me along the lines of, we have 600 different software vendors. And he's, you know, that's one of their initiatives. Hey, why do we have so many different software vendors? Aren't these things doing kind of similar things? Let's say, you know, somebody who's kind of grown up in this agile discipline, what might Lean have to offer in terms of solving a problem like that?
Yeah. And software has developments that look really similar, like domain-driven design, business architecture mapping. They have their attempts in places. So when you get to this level of conversations with tech people, and it's, you're like a geek in Lean and you understand the flow stuff, if you can find those people that are concerned for the system in that way, you'll find you have a lot in common. And you'll find, right? So in an organization, you have certain people that tend to look end to end. In your tech departments in large organization, there's some guy or a couple guys and a gal or whatever, and they see the whole system. And they're like, in the same way that someone in the world of a lean transformation person is like, if I could just get these people upstream to understand these people downstream, they'd stop making each other's lives miserable. There's a tech person or several tech people who are looking at the whole system and are trying to help. And meantime, there are people in the organization like, I need you to turn on this software for me. I did this trial license of Trello. It's amazing. I hate Jira. It sucks. This, and they've spun up their own versions, and they're coercing the tech team to launch yet another tool that doesn't fully integrate, that doesn't share databases, and they're struggling, right? It's tough. I can't blame the tech people for all the tech solutions, because I think it's the business people who've asked for it.
So this is a really interesting topic to me for a number of reasons, but from the perspective of Lean Enterprise Institute, is there some guidance, some best practices, some things that you would recommend? I mean, even, you know, job titles, jobs to be done, like these companies that are trying to solve this problem of waste.
Yeah.
What might they look to? What might they look to set up inside their organizations to approach this in a lean way?
Yeah, so one of the things that has been advocated from the early days with WOMAC and others has been like, create a job for someone who looks at the whole value stream. In automobile development, when you create a new automobile, it's a chief engineer, and they have a process to take everybody through that. But someone who looks at the whole value stream and can effectively model it. We have, if you're into LEI's material, the value stream mapping is one. And that's like a set of starter routines to attempt to understand the sequence of steps and value and flow and stagnation and pull. But that same principle exists where, one, there's a set of work. And the set of work is to expose the process end to end. And the end to ends are pretty clear, like, I don't have a customer. Now I have a customer. With one customer, they may have many orders. the customer places an order, the order gets shipped and billed. Like that's end to end.
Pause there a little bit and have you drill down. So value stream mapping makes perfect sense to you. You've done it a bunch. I don't know if Agile has a different word for that. I'm kind of thinking like customer journey maps or something that's probably similar. But I'm also kind of picturing this person who works inside of an organization. Every company is an evolving thing, and not every company is completely well-structured in this, you know, the format that Ellie, I would recommend. There's a lot of people that are different places on the journey. And inside these companies, there's somebody who's like, yes, that thing that Tyson's saying, that's what we need. We need somebody who does that. You know, they go and they ask their boss and they're like, oh, we don't have one of those. I have a favorite quote that is, if you don't have one, you are one.
Like if there's no one else, it's you.
Yeah. If you don't have a lawn guy, you are the lawn guy. If you don't have a dishwasher, you are the dishwasher. If you don't have a process engineer, I mean, at some level, right, it's you. So how might you talk to somebody who's listening to this saying, I think we need one of those?
Yeah. So I had a conversation with somebody just yesterday. He was stuck in the middle of a set of engineers who were churning out something. And then he had to take it and make sure it was appropriate for SAP and how to bill of materials. And then he handed it to someone else. Right. I'm like, in my head, I'm like, the things that you need are outside of your control. Like you need one of these value stream managers, or you need somebody to take your executive team through a workflow modeling exercise so that they can gain a sense that there is an end-to-end value stream and expose this layer. But he didn't have leverage to do that, right? If he did, we should have made some introductions. We could have journeyed down this path. And LEI can help with that, right? We get these calls from like the ones that, I don't know, they break my heart. I have sympathy for them. Are these like company hired a new lean person? And they come in, they're trying to get leverage with the executive team. It's tough. They can't get resources. They can't get the focus they want. And they ask us, right? And I'm like, well, if you can get the leverage with your executive team to focus on this, then maybe we can make some gains. But if you can't, right, it's hard. This gentleman, one thing that I encouraged him to do, as I said, can you look upstream? Can you see in their process? Right? Yes. Okay. If you can stop viewing your work as end to end within the purview of when you touch him, when you let it leave, and you can start to string it together, that's a huge step. And then if you can model that on the wall, and then if you can start to layer in the metrics, like if you paint reality on the wall, and value stream mapping enables you to do that. Once the map's up there, like the whole conversation changes completely. It has to, because they say, really, products sitting that long? Really, there are that many errors? So if you're listening to me and you're like, I don't have the leverage, I can't do it, I would buy one of our books, the value stream mapping book, or look at process and workflow modeling techniques and attempt to paint the picture, not from your perspective, but from the client's perspective as to what's important to them with this unit of work or product or service or packet of knowledge as it moves across. And you can get some leverage. It will change the conversation, and then you can nudge differently. You can speak from a different place.
I think that's such a good concept there. Again, I think people that are drawn to this type of work at some level, you know, people have different levels of patience, right? I've talked to a lot of folks who, particularly in consulting, because they just don't have the patience to work inside of an organization for a long time when change doesn't happen fast enough. So if you're somebody who's frustrated with something, that's a very good thing. It means that you have this seed for making change, making things better. Definitely an art and a science and a skill. And maybe, you know, you can learn more about this skill from LEI resources, lean.org resources, because you said something that resonates with me. I'm famous internally for asking people to draw me a picture of concept. I'm like, just draw me a picture. You know, a napkin, just draw me a picture of what you're saying. Because if you can draw a picture that I can understand, it tells me that you understand.
It's perfect.
So pictures can be simple and very simple in my word. A value stream is a great way to say, hey, is this how things work? You know, without going to a boss and being like accusatory, because it's very easy to do when you have ideas for improvement to tell everybody
like, what's your problem? Doing wrong. How come you can't see it this way?
Yeah. So I think that it's a very, if there's anybody who's been frustrated with something, like, why can't other people see this thing that I see so easy? there's something in this lean discipline that you can learn from to get your problem solved in a way. The concept that sometimes you need to slow down to go faster. There's ways to communicate those problems. And you mentioned the value of a sure and a value stream is one of those.
Yeah. If you can model it, you know, the model, the whole thing, you can draw to your boundaries and a little beyond, and then ask people to fill in their part. It changes problem solving, being frustrated. I've been so frustrated so many times. The speed at which I can move from frustration to curiosity and approaching either the leader above me or beside me with curiosity and attempting to understand is directly correlated to the speed at which we can take meaningful action on the problem.
I think that's, if there's a few things that people could take from this, you mentioned curiosity. Be curious about the problem rather than, you know, maybe accusatory or finger pointing, like be genuinely curious. I think you shared that as something that has driven you, is just the general curious. I think that's such a good attribute to embrace that will get you far in life in general.
Often my trigger is frustration. And it's like, when I'm feeling that trigger, I'm like, wait a minute, how can I be curious? Because it doesn't always trigger as curiosity. Sometimes it does.
No, I think that's a good point. It's not natural necessarily. But if you find yourself frustrated at something, you talked about complex systems, and I'm into health and fitness, and I'm somebody who probably default feels like a responsibility to make good eating choices and all these things. And so I feel like responsible for that. And somebody shared with me the idea of what comes to mind is the Deming, like the red bead experiment, where if you have a process in place, what does he call it? I forget the term that he used, but a willing and able, somebody running that process, they should be able to get the similar outcome. Mm-hmm. Like we've got such big systemic process problems as a society where the average person does not have a good outcome when it comes to like food, our food systems for example.
Absolutely. There's so many like factors working against you, essentially. You're going to be working 9 hours a day with some overtime. You're going to be in a cafeteria that doesn't have good access to food. You're going to get off late at night when healthy options aren't even available. There are so many things that can stack up against a person in that particular environment that making good choices isn't the default mode.
It's like, how can we make it hard to not make the right choices? Right? And that was one of those examples where I was like, it just gave me a different perspective on what it means to build like what you might call an anti-fragile system. There's so much depth to this lean topic in general. We could probably talk for hours and hopefully we could have you come back sometime and go deeper into some of these. I've just got a few questions. I'll refer to these as the rapid fire. So these are just short, one word, one sentence questions for you. You mentioned a number of books today. What is a book that's either on your current reading list or one that you recommend people should definitely pick up?
Reading list. I'm actually reading the Quran right now. So I cycle through religious books. There's so many good books. I think it's more important to find yourself in the path of learning and growing than like the particular selection. So I'd say pick up a book that triggers your curiosity.
Anyone that you want to suggest we add to our reading list?
Well, I think the Managing on Purpose for Hoshin and Strategy Deployment, that's a critical one. And I think it can really help organizations right now.
Is there a mentor that helped you along the way that you maybe want to acknowledge?
I've had countless incredible mentors, from Bob Miller at JBS Beef to Paulo Falcone, Gary Peterson, Tolan Brown, David Siebert. OC Tanner's been a great place. I'm surrounded by great mentors at LEI, John Shook, Josh Howell, the whole team. There's too many to list, but I'm a sponge and they know that. And I just thank them all for letting me pester them relentlessly with hypotheticals and situations and questions.
That's all. Do you have a favorite go-to tool from the Lean Toolbox that you might choose as a favorite or a most used?
No, actually, I don't. That's a tough one. I can't think of a favorite tool. I think my favorite principle is flow.
That's a great answer. I'm a huge fan of flow. Finish this sentence. Lean is...
It's an effective attempt to build a learning and adaptive organization that's capable of self-sustaining growth and aligning to changing customer value.
I love it. I love it. A tool for, I'm summarizing, a tool to self-regulating, self-learning.
It's our best attempt at developing self-adaptive and learning organization.
I think that's a great way to summarize it. For anybody that wants to follow up with you or maybe are there some resources or things that you guys have going on at Lean Enterprise Institute that you want to share with folks or maybe a way to get in contact with you?
Yeah, I'm on LinkedIn, obviously. Feel free to connect with me there. The lean.org's website has workshops and the classes and the on-demand and the books. And we have a conference coming up in Texas is the next one, I believe. So hop on there. Send me an email if you like. You can find that access through the website too. If you're deeply curious or passionate about something, it's hard for me to say no. So I love learners and I love collaborators that'll push my thinking. So I encourage you to reach out.
Wonderful. Wonderful. Well, thanks so much for joining us today. We really appreciate you coming here to share some insights and experiences and some of the stories. And until next time, keep driving progress and sparking change.